Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here with mostly very good people. I don't know if my presentation is pulling up. Oh, it is up. I need the clicker. So basically, what I'm going to do is tell the story of our time in Australia. I'll end with a few comments about private property, and then we'll, after Julie speaks, it'll be opened up for general Q&A. I was born in North Dakota. My parents had a stock or cattle operation up there. They were irrigation pioneers. They put in some of the first center pivots in the plains of North Dakota. I was one of five children. We had very tough winters from 1968 to 1979, and so in 79, my family moved down to southeastern Oklahoma, bought a cattle ranch on the Red River, and that's where I grew up. We five children were very involved in the day-to-day activities on the ranch. We worked our butts off growing up. I'm sure if most of you haven't experienced it yourselves, you'll be very pleased to know that butt tissue regenerates nicely. My husband, Matt, grew up in Amarillo. His parents were university professors, but he was always very interested in agriculture. He went to Texas A&M and studied animal science. And one of his first jobs out of college was working at Cactus Feeder's 80,000-head Stratford feed yard. And Matt always wanted to own one of his own. We met and got married in 1997, and our first child was born in 2000. Nobody laughed at the first picture, so I'll go back to it. That's not really us. How many Okies do I have in the room? A couple Okies. The rest of the room believed that was us because I'm from Oklahoma. She's got a cigarette in her hand, by the way. So in 2001, we took our life savings and moved to Western Australia to build a feedlot south of the small town of Nerajin, 2.5 hours inland from Perth, the most remote state capital in the world. The exchange rate at the time was 2-1, so one US dollar would buy 2 Aussie dollars, and we could start smaller in Australia and grow with the industry, which was in its infancy. About 30% of the beef in Australia is grain finished, whereas here it's about 100%. There was great market opportunity in the wheat belt of Western Australia, good water, about 10 million tons of grain exported annually, tens of thousands of cattle exported live, a state 3.5 times larger than Texas with a population of only 2.2 million. I was 31, Matt was 38, and Kate was not yet 1 year old. We had three more children down under, all born in the local Nerajin Hospital. All six of us are dual citizens. We found our ideal piece of property, a 600-acre paddock south of Nerajin on the second day we were in town. We hired an environmental consulting firm out of Queensland to help us put together an approval package, including CAD design of layout of the feed yard over actual topographical maps. We spent a lot of time and effort on both environmental and animal welfare designs. We were always upfront about what we were doing and had spoken to the local government, the Water Corporation, and the Department of Environment and Conservation, or DEC, from the beginning. We spoke to neighbors, had an open public meeting, and worked hard to meet and exceed all of the requirements for approval. We thought it was an ideal location for us. Our property adjoined a 12,000-head hog operation, or piggery, as they're called in Australia, that had been there for 20 years, and a 2-year ag vocational school on the other. It was zoned rural in the middle of farming country. The Shire of Nerajin granted conditional approval in April of 2002, and we expected an answer from DEC within 45 days, although we had been verbally assured that it would not take that long. They had already looked over our application and told us that as soon as we had local government approval, the DEC's decision should come quickly. Of course, as most of you probably know, when you're dealing with bureaucracies, that's never the case. After much red tape and runaround, we received our works approval to construct in August of 2002. Then there was an appeal against that works approval. It was lodged by a subdivision resident about 2 kilometers away who had built their house knowing that the piggery was already there. The appeals process was time-consuming and expensive. We almost went broke before we got started, as we didn't have any income for such a long period of time. Eventually, though, the ruling went our way, but the department decided that in order to give security to the complainants, we would be subject to an annual license. We did not have a problem with that, as we weren't planning to do anything wrong. We put the first post in the ground in February of 2003, and the first cattle went on feed in June. It had been a long, tedious, and arduous journey, but we were pleased to have gone through that rigorous approval process. We felt reassured that both Narrogin and the state of Western Australia had decided that intensive animal agriculture was wanted locally and in the state. So from that point onward, our only challenges would be to build an industry, market our beef overseas, deal with labor, and grow our business. Because we didn't have a heap of money behind us, we had always planned to build in increments. While the entire 15,000 head development was planned and approved, we started with 1,000 head and then built out of cash flow up to 4,500, 6,000, and then 10,000. I probably don't have to tell most of you in the room about the day-to-day challenges we faced, but in addition to those normal market challenges came complaints from the same small group of complainants who had complained about the piggery and who had opposed us from the beginning. The stated complaint was odor, but we found out over time that we were dealing with something much bigger than a few neighbors with sensitive noses. We were up against animal rights activists and environmental extremists. In 2007, we had built to a 10,000 head capacity. When we applied for a license to operate our final stage of development, the small group of activists complained once again. By the way, the only correlation we ever discovered between complaints and any other factor was complaints and license renewal time. While DEC had always responded to complaints, they never seemed to overreact. After all, they were aware that these complainants existed before they gave us final approval to build. Now I'm going to back up in time. Prior to 2005, the Australian federal government initiated mandatory reporting of pollutants under what was called the National Pollutant Inventory, or NPI, every year under threat of a $6,000 fine for individuals or a $25,000 fine for incorporated bodies. We were obliged to sign an admission of guilt. In the case of lot feeders, our chosen pollutant was ammonia. We had to multiply the number of cattle we had fed by their NPI number, write down the answer, and sign. The only problem was their number was physiologically impossible. It meant the cattle were emitting more nitrogen than they were taking in. Also, every detail of every producer, GPS positions, name, address, phone numbers, email addresses, everything was to go up on a public centralized database. It was a golden windfall for groups like the Animal Liberation Front. Starting in 2005, in his role as president of the Western Australian Lot Feeders Association, Matt started pushing back by publicly questioning where their numbers came from. No one could answer. And he also got the centralized database idea quashed. We found out through Freedom of Information requests years later that even at that early date, DEC staff had put Matt on a watch list of sorts. In May of 2007, Matt attended a meeting in Perth between regulators, environmental groups, and industry, including mining, oil and gas, transport, retail, feedlots, everybody. And the meeting was about transitioning that NPI system to a new system which would include so-called greenhouse gases into the required reporting. At that meeting, Matt stated that he did not believe that greenhouse gases were pollutants, that the science behind the climate change movement was not settled, and he handed out copies of the Great Global Warming Swindle DVD. He was very popular with the industry people present. Matt did not expect that his views would be shared by very many people in that room, but he did believe that he had the freedom to state his opinions without fear of reprisal. Soon after this, though, the Department of Environment and Conservation showed up on our property with their police-like lights flashing. They suddenly increased their reliance upon complaints against our business. My files of correspondence with DEC increased dramatically from that time forward. Also after that May meeting, the Environmental Defenders Office, or EDO, a state and federally funded not-for-profit organization, got involved with a small group of local complainants. They came to town and got that handful of complainants organized into an incorporated body. They got a name, the Narragin Environmental Action Team, NEAT, and EDO taught them how to, in general, gum up the works so that our project would die on the vine before coming to fruition. The vast majority of local people were highly supportive or at least ambivalent about our business being in Narragin. There was a high degree of attention given our development, but mostly from people who were interested in economic activity and ensuring that that ag-based community grew and thrived with real productive businesses, providing a base for that local sustainability. In early 2008, we hired attorneys in Perth as it had become apparent that a positive outcome was not going to be forthcoming from DEC. After getting up to speed on our case, the solicitor and barrister suggested that we meet with Dr. Johanna Shumbi, an environmental attorney. He offers two floors above the DEC in the nicest building on St. George's Terrace in Perth. He basically suggested that we crawl on hands and knees back to the DEC, admit we were wrong, and hire him, and he would fix everything. Since we hadn't done anything wrong, and because we couldn't afford him, after meeting with him for 40 minutes, we declined his further involvement. His bill was $4,000. In 2009, we discovered that Dr. Johanna Shumbi was the convener of EDO, the Environmental Defender's Office. He had never disclosed or even attempted to allude to any such connection. To cut a very long story short, I'm just looking at my slides thinking they're going through too quickly. Just pay attention to this waterway as defined by DEC, and that last one, the retention pond that was too big. To cut a very long story short, too small, I mean, in the license issued to us in March of 2008, DEC took our license conditions from a reasonable 8 to a draconian 33. They limited our throughput to effectively half of our built-up capacity. They claimed that our retention pond was not large enough and that we would have to double its size. They said we were located near waterways and that we had to do more fundamental work to protect them. All of this over 6 years after we filed our original application and 5 years after we had been operating. We fought the ruling, experienced fully the chicanery of both political parties, and witnessed the domination of the bureaucracies, which laughed at the democratic processes. We could not cash flow our business at the reduced occupancy and with the additional capital expenditures we were required to make to satisfy the new license conditions, which, by the way, we were legally obliged to comply with while it was under appeal. The appeal took 18 months. We laid off the last of our fantastic employees in November of 2009. It's really hard to think about my husband. We lived and officed on the site. And whenever I think about him coming back into the house that day after he went out and told the final 8, we had over 20 full-time equivalent employees at our height. The look on his face, and I've never heard him make a sound like that before, the sound like he was trying to keep from screaming through his tears, it was awful. I think it was the hardest thing he's ever had to do. We shipped the last of the cattle just before Christmas in 2009. We were still hopeful that a positive outcome would be the end game. We owed millions of dollars to the bank and to unsecured creditors. We just knew that right would triumph over the might of bureaucracy and these dark green groups. We could not imagine, with that high degree of local support that we had and the initial approval process that we had been through, plus the fact that we hadn't done anything wrong, the only thing we had ever been written up for was we moved our diesel tank from the bottom of the hill to the top of the hill, and we hadn't put the bunding around it yet. That's the only environmental field notice we ever got. We just couldn't imagine that our outcome would be anything but positive. In March of 2010, the DEC finally delivered our new license, knowing that our bank had given us till the middle of March to give them a solution. The new license was just as bad, if not worse than the first. Our operations manager and close personal friend, Lindley Bosley, I don't know if those slides have already gone, soon after hearing the news of the new license, committed suicide. He knew that that license ensured that our beautiful feed yard, which he had helped to build and manage. I'll just go back to Lindley. Would never operate again. He had taken part-time employment since we laid them off, with the idea that he would come back to us when a reasonable solution was arrived at. Rather than supporting us as partners in our fight, our bank, the National Australia Bank, did strange things. Just before we filed a case against the Department of Environment, the bank appointed receivers and tried to take control over everything, including our case against the department. So we ended up fighting a taxpayer-funded government department, the largest bank in Australia, and a group of less than exemplary receivers who couldn't care less about the good people who trusted us enough to do business with us and to whom we owed money, or about our feed yard ever operating again. The battle dragged on and on. We learned that the court system was very much a part of the intricate web of lawyers, environmental activists, and political players. While we had an excellent case, the shenanigans of the legal system ensured that our case was never heard. It seemed we were always jousting over minor issues that had nothing to do with the fundamental case. Finally, last year, we abandoned our case, our property, our hope for any justice in Australia. We moved back to the USA and are starting over. Matt is now managing a 35,000-head yard in the Texas Panhandle. Our kids are healthy and happy. Kate's in sixth grade, Abby's in fourth, Will's in second, and Luke's in first. Life goes on, and I feel extremely blessed to have a strong marriage and four wonderful children, and I've met awesome people because of what's happened to us. I gave this talk down in Tampa in February at the National Cattlemen's Beef Producers Annual Convention, Cattle Industry Convention, to the American National Cattlewomen. And Sarah Boningkamp, who's the executive director of ANCW, said beforehand, Janet, I need to know what your main takeaways are going to be for our members. I said, if I just tell my story, everybody's going to have their own takeaway. Everybody's going to get something different from our story. But I will share with you guys, in hindsight, after everything that's happened, what my main takeaways are, for what it's worth. I believe that private property is the core to everything. I believe that private property owners must be the ones to determine what happens upon their property and with their business. We must not have a one-size-fits-all top-down approach to ranching or farming or any business. Second, the only way to effectively fight centralized planning is to reestablish the sanctity of private property. As we in agriculture have become more and more productive and efficient, we've been able to free up people to do other things other than produce food. This means that 99% of our population now is engaged in something other than production agriculture. You guys know all of that. But I think what we underestimate is the level of planning about agriculture that is taking place in New York City at the United Nations, in Washington, D.C., in Canberra, Australia, for example, and at local government levels. I believe there's only one way to effectively fight that, and it involves reestablishing the sanctity of private property. Improvements in animal care happen because of private ownership, not in spite of it. Animal well-being is a topic that's very near and dear to my heart. We built our feed yard with much care and attention to design as it relates to animal behavior. I gave talks in Australia at the national level about this topic. I gave tours of our facility in Western Australia, and I worked cattle in our facility. I grew up working cattle at various ranches and sale barns, and I've never seen cattle flow through a facility as beautifully as they did at the one we built in Western Australia. It worked a charm. I was really proud of that. Once again, though, I believe that this has to be up to each individual producer to adopt whatever techniques work for him or her. We must hold private property as the highest priority and avoid a top-down, one-size-fits-all approach to production. Agriculturalists have learned, we do this every day, we learn that the only way to survive is to continually improve. There is no such thing as best practice when each individual is constantly improving. When there is a mandated best practice, no individual is allowed to improve. Finally, this statement, I'm not doing anything wrong, so I have nothing to hide, so I will cooperate with everyone, anyone, is extremely dangerous. This works with the vast majority of people, but it does not work with the people who are fundamentally opposed to what we do for a living. It does not work with the people who are diametrically opposed to the concept of private property. It does not work with those who are philosophically on a plane completely separate than the one we operate on. Discriminating between the honest parties and the ones with malintent cannot happen in the absence of knowledge of the fundamental problem. That is what I would like for each farmer and rancher and agribusiness to be aware of. I'm here because I hope I can help stem the tide of this craziness. I hope you all will use me in whatever way you deem necessary to accomplish that goal, and I very much appreciate the opportunity to be here with you. Thank you.